Valtteri, it's James. It's time for another Flat Chat. Well, the May edition of GP Racing is now fully ensconced on the shelves, and we're talking about the big issues of the moment in Formula One. Why fully ensconced on the shelves? And why is it that perhaps subscribers have already forgotten reading it? Yes, we're a week late recording, and it's all my fault for scheduling discombobulation and other inefficiencies. Anyhow, we are now able, because of my scheduling stupidity, we are joined by Mark Gallagher, no longer in Australia. Shaking off the jet lag, Mark.
I am shaking off the jet lag, although I came back to England thinking it was the summer in the Northern Hemisphere, and it appears to be raining every day. So I'm not quite sure that that's worked out terribly well. But yes, back from Australia, no one on the plane, actually no one in my cabin at all between Adelaide and Singapore.
Oh, that sounds like heaven.
One person in the cabin with me between Singapore and London. So I don't quite know how Singapore Airlines managed to do all of that. But
at a great loss, I imagine.
Yeah, at a great government compensated loss, I would think, for Singapore Airlines. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure the two of you have been through Singapore a few times. It's normally a heaving airport, and it was utterly empty. There wasn't a single person to be seen. So yeah, we do still live in strange times, but nice to get back here just as lockdown was beginning to ease. So I'm assuming you were all down the pub quick.
Oh, I wish.
A quick pint, no?
No, I was winning a virtual bike race on Zwift last night instead of going to the pub.
Okay, and did you win it?
Yes, I've got a little gold trophy next to my name on ZwiftPower.com.
Oh, wow, right, okay.
Once all the cheats have been got rid of.
Congratulations.
How long did this race last, by the way?
Oh, only 20 minutes.
Oh, that's not that much of an achievement then, really, is it?
Next Tuesday is the last race of the WTRL League, and it's on the Surrey Hills course, which is going to last about an hour and a quarter. It's got why am I saying it's got 800 meters of climbing when you're in your garage? But it's got 600 to 800 meters of simulated climbing. So lots of pretending to ride up hills with other people also in their garages or, you know, in their air conditioned home offices. Who knows what they're doing while they're in there. But anyway, we're digressing massively. Hello, Ben Anderson. Fresh, no mutant superpowers courtesy of your COVID jab.
Not yet, no. Although perhaps I'm hearing the voice of Bill Gates in my head every so often. I'm not sure.
No need for a mobile phone mast in your house.
No, but I have been spending time also at an airport, Gatwick, today, getting my son COVID tested because he was sent home from nursery with a temperature, which subsequently didn't exist. And I can confirm also that it was very, very quiet.
If only Gatwick could be like that at all times of the year, then it would actually be, you know, not the seventh circle of hell. It usually is when we pass through there. In the words of a rather excellent suitcase packing video I once saw on YouTube, Oh the Humanity.
And who was the author of this suitcase packing video?
I think I saw it on Peter Windsor's channel. The author remains anonymous to this day. Anyhow, so I think that same author might have contributed something to this month's GP Racing magazine. And dragging us back onto the subject, because, you know, we've only got an hour to play with, and we'll get hideously bad reviews if we keep on waffling about the minutiae of our daily lives. We have got an interview with Valtteri Bottas that is not only very frank, it was also exclusive. Unusual these days, but we managed to secure it. And Valtteri was very open and honest when he spoke to us. And we basically took him through his career up to this point and asked what he needs to do to beat Lewis Hamilton and keep his job with Mercedes. And chaps, that's quite a big ask, isn't it? Because let's not put too fine a point on it. He got his ass kicked in Spain and hasn't been massively impressive so far this year.
The whole Valtteri situation, and of course, is not helped by the fact that if you dare to stray onto social media and look at comments about Valtteri.
Oh, dangerous game.
I mean, the pylon on Valtteri is just unbelievable. Of course, you've got a huge George Russell fan base, particularly here in the UK, and naturally lots of George Russell fans want to see him replace Valtteri. And you get lots of comments around around it, to the point where I think just 2 weeks ago, Valtteri had to kind of dismiss the fact that he could be dropped by Mercedes mid-season this year. And indeed, Toto Wolff then picked up on that point to say, you know, he's got a contract for this season. But that kind of shows where we're already at. And we've only, the season's only just started, and Valtteri's been given a kicking left, right, and centre. And yet there seems to be a, I don't know whether it's an intentionally people avoiding the topic of the fact that no one is going to join that team and beat Lewis Hamilton, because that's just the way it is. Lewis is the team leader. He is a 7-time world champion, now on course for an 8th world championship title. The role of his teammate is to provide as much support as possible and, yes, to win races if the opportunity arises, particularly in the early part of the season. But we've seen enough, haven't we, over the years to know the pecking order there. And quite frankly, when people say, well, you know, what's Valtteri got to do to beat Lewis, or what, you know, George Russell should come in and beat Lewis, or someone else should come in and beat Lewis. Everyone else has been trying to beat Lewis for years. I mean, they haven't achieved it. And this is not going to happen, because if that was to happen, Lewis Hamilton would leave Formula One. He is not there to make up the numbers. He's there to win races and win world championships. And at the age of 36, he's driving the wheels off that car, making perfect race decisions. It got this, you know, incredible, seamless relationship with the team where they can optimize strategies, and Lewis can do exactly what's required of him and get the most out of the car. And really what it comes back to is the fact that, and I'm sorry, Valtteri, if you're listening to this, but as a number two driver, Valtteri ought to be finishing second every time to Lewis. And the fact that he's not finishing second every time, that he's sometimes being beaten by, you know, by Max or by other combinations, depending, you know, and he does have the odd weekend where things really don't go well. And there's where the criticism comes in, because you really feel like they ought to be banging in 1-2s all the time in a kind of Senna-Prost way, to go back into ancient history. But it's a fact that he quite often struggles to even finish second. He can get on the podium, but then he's had some pretty horrendous races where things have really gone badly. And I love the fact, Stuart, that in your interview with him, he talks about his bad luck. He talks about the fact that everything seems to go so well for Lewis, and, you know, what does Valtteri have to do? And I don't know Valtteri. I know some of the people around him and have supported him. Of course, I did a lot of work with Mika Häkkinen, who was part of Valtteri's management team. And my observation is that, as in any sport, if things aren't going well, people can tighten up. And the more they tighten up, and sometimes perhaps the harder they try, the worse things go. And, you know, I follow Valtteri on social media, and you see him, you know, in the wintertime going off to Finland and, you know, getting away from it all. And you talk about the kind of the five Valtteri Bottas chapters, don't you, in the excellent interview, and the sort of the five versions of Valtteri that we've got. And I still don't think we've seen the version that actually works for him. And that's the thing that he needs. You know, you can come out and say, right, this year I'm going to be super aggressive and I'm going to go wheel to wheel with Lewis. It ain't going to happen, because that's just, you know, that's actually not in the script. We think about the number two drivers, and I say number two, he, you know, it may not say that he's number two in his contract, although I suspect it might well say that in Lewis's contract that he's number one, yes, which is a different thing. But the reality is that, you know, when you go back and you look at the number two drivers down through history, you know, the Mark Webber having to watch Sebastian Vettel win 4 world championship titles, the Rubens Barrichello partnered with Michael, the Eddie Irvine, the Gerhard Burgers of this world. You know, all of these guys have come and tried and seen what it's like to be up against the number one driver. The number one driver, not purely because of their ability, but because of their position in the team and the way the team has been built around them. And it's really unenviable. And, yeah, I mean, it certainly looks like it's perhaps Valtteri's coming to the end of his Mercedes chapter. I don't think he's yet found what's right for him.
Yeah, that's why I thought the story was worth doing, really, because Bottas is interesting in the sense that, you know, where exactly is his head at after this 5-year period? You know, he said something that struck me in your interview, Cotters, about how Mercedes expect him to have won a title by now. You know, they don't employ him for 5 years and expect him just to, you know, pick up a few decent points and a few podiums and some pole positions. But that kind of goes against what Mark is saying is expected of him, which is perhaps in reality, they just need him to be knocking at the door, the guy that provides a support act to Lewis, the wingman, which he so hates as a status. And he's really doing that. And it's helped, I think, by the fact that Red Bull's number two driver hasn't been able to perform, whoever that driver has been in the last couple of seasons. That kind of lets Bottas off the hook, because if he had a stronger challenge from the second Red Bull car and that car was right up there and Bottas was lagging behind, I think he'd be under a lot more pressure than he is. Not to say he isn't under pressure, because you can't spend that long in the team up against Lewis, as good as Lewis is, and be second best without pressure manifesting, certainly from outside. He seems to handle it really well. I think he's got a very good mentality now for dealing with it. Feels like his story has kind of mirrored Webber's. It's interesting you mentioned him, because obviously Mark had a really good chance to win the 2010 World Championship and it didn't quite work out for him. And then the situation kind of shifted from that point onwards gradually against him and more towards Vettel as Vettel gained the momentum. And it kind of feels a little bit similar when Bottas was first at Mercedes. The new rules had come in. Ferrari were much more competitive. There were many more cars in the mix suddenly. There was a whole new dynamic in the team because there'd been a bad atmosphere after Rosberg had left. So Lewis was recalibrating at that point. And he didn't really get going in the first half of 2017. It took most of that season before he really hit form. And that was a chance for Bottas. But Bottas wasn't in a situation like Rosberg had been, where he knew the surroundings and was able to just hit the ground running. He had to get up to speed. And of course, then 2018, everything went horribly wrong for him. Similar dynamic with Ferrari up there. Perhaps more chances to nick points, nick races, be in the mix. The car not always working that well for Lewis. But Bottas had an awful season, didn't win a race. And it just feels like from that point, you know, if there's trust or faith, either from within or without, that he can really get the job done, it's not going to be there, is it? Because you expect such a better level of performance from a guy in a car that good, even if it wasn't always the best. And of course, I think he's had to recalibrate since then. And in 2019, 2020 and this year, it feels like he's trying to catch up to where Lewis is in terms of how Lewis approaches Formula One. I'm going to do more things for myself. I'm going to live my life outside of Formula One to help take the pressure off. Now I'm going to be more selfish and demand more from the team. But it's almost too little, too late. You know, Lewis is so settled, like you said, Mark, so in sync with the team around him. And Toto Wolff and everyone else aren't going to make the mistakes they made when Rosberg was there. They're not going to allow any kind of bad atmosphere or negativity or dirty tricks played behind the scenes to destabilize, because they're too concerned about the threats from outside. It was Ferrari before, it's Red Bull now. So, and then when Valtteri's saying he won't stoop to that level, he likes to do, he's talking on the track, you know, fair competition and the best man wins, which is very noble, but it just seems like he has no wriggle room. How does he bring down the greatest driver of his generation without resorting to the sort of tactics that Nico Rosberg did?
Comes down to what you said, Mark, about trying to find a version of himself that he's comfortable with. It's interesting that he's he's identified a need for more arm around the shoulder treatment from Toto Wolff and secured that. And it doesn't seem to be working for him, does it? The Toto coming on the radio and going, come on, Valtteri, come on.
He went slower, didn't he?
Yeah, well,
it's like your boss standing behind your shoulder going, what's going on here?
Work harder, you mangy dogs.
Work faster, yeah.
But it would annoy you, wouldn't it? If you're in the middle of a Grand Prix, you know, presumably you're driving as fast as you can under whatever context the team has given you, and then you've got Toto on the radio saying, come on, you know, you must be thinking, oh, really, you know, I don't need to be told this. But I'm really clear about the fact that Mercedes, while they they would have been happy for Valtteri to win a world championship in a year where Lewis had some problems. They don't see Valtteri as beating Lewis in a straight fight. And that's not his job. And, you know, I think, you know, Gerhard Berger spoke to Eddie Irvine when he joined Michael at Ferrari. And, you know, Gerhard gave him some advice. You know, having been teammate to Ayrton Senna, his takeaway was learn to love it. You know, you're driving for the best team in the world. And yes, you might be having to follow, you might be having to play bridesmaid, you know, to the number one in the team. But there are worse things to be happening in your life than to finishing second most weekends and then winning the odd Grand Prix. And by the way, earning an unconscionable amount of money to drive a racing car and to enjoy the lifestyle of a Formula One driver. So it's all about, and I have no doubt that he is massively competitive. I mean, Valtteri is driven. And let's be clear, for all that people criticize him from time to time, we all see those qualifying laps that he puts in where he's either a whisker behind Lewis or sometimes a whisker in front of Lewis. And he's driving that car as fast as Lewis Hamilton over a single lap in qualifying. Now, he may not be able to sustain that level of performance in races. And Valtteri is a very particular type of driver. There are certain circuits, for example, that he likes. Lewis seems to be pretty good everywhere. You know, if every Grand Prix was in Sochi, Valtteri Bottas would have won probably four world championship titles by now because he scored a podium for Williams in 2014. He has finished first or second for the last 4 years at Mercedes. He won twice, finished second twice. He loves Sochi. He's quick round there. He's obviously in his comfort zone on that track. But going back to, you know, what you were talking about, I was just calling up on my phone a tweet that Mercedes-Benz put out 3 days ago. They have the side pod bodywork of Lewis Hamilton's and Nico Rosberg's cars from the Spanish Grand Prix in 2016, the damaged side pods. And they have those on the walls of the factory. Ron Dennis might have had the biggest trophy cabinet the world has ever seen. Mercedes-Benz have got an example of failure on the wall of their factory. As a reminder to everyone of what happens when the two people driving for you forget that they drive for a team and that the objective is to win for the team. And I thought that was an incredibly powerful statement because it shows the mentality inside Mercedes. James Allison was on my podcast, I think on last November, and James talked at some length about the pain that they endured as a team during the Rosberg-Hamilton years and how destructive that became. He described it, I think, as a downward cycle. And they have no interest in going back there. So whenever people come on social media and say, oh, Valtteri Bottas has to be replaced by somebody who can take the fight to Lewis Hamilton. No, that's not what needs to happen. Mercedes-Benz want to win the world championship and have two drivers who score as many constructors' points as possible so they win that title too. And so long as Lewis Hamilton wants to keep doing what he's doing, given that he does it so brilliantly, there really isn't much of a look in. And I think that, you know, for the George Russell fans, let me just say this. Be careful what you wish for, because Valtteri Bottas spent all his time at Williams wishing to get that drive at Mercedes. And as he admits in your interview, Cotters, there were then times subsequently where he thought about stopping. Actually, it's an unhappy experience. And how often have we seen, gentlemen, situations where a driver in a lesser team achieves a level of success, which actually they will find difficult to emulate elsewhere. I mean, we're going to talk about Pierre Gasly in a moment, but you know, you think about Pierre Gasly and how much more settled he has been at AlphaTauri, and that's maybe his happy place. And I do sometimes think that, you know, we all get so carried away with, you know, how do you win so many Grand Prix? How do you win world championships? How do you win? Actually, for a lot of racing drivers, they just need to be in a happy place where they can perform well in a given team, in a given car, and have a successful career. And when you see, for example, Romain Grosjean finishing, you know, getting a pole position in Indianapolis on the road circuit and finishing second, how happy are we all for Romain Grosjean to be out there performing at the front again in IndyCar racing after a pretty dispiriting time in Formula One? It's really important that professional sports people are happy in what they do and that they're able to show their capabilities. And sometimes it's easier to show your capability in a lesser car than it is to be at the sharp end of Formula One with all of the pressure that comes with it.
So do we think then that Bottas is in his happy place? Do we think that he's accepted his supposed standing as number two driver within the team? Or do we think that he genuinely believes he's got a shot at least a fair crack at trying to beat Lewis, and that he's number two by default of the fact that Lewis wins more races? What's your impression, Connors? Because you interviewed him. So where is his head at? Do you think that he's kidding himself, or do you think he's accepted it? Not that he would say it explicitly.
The thing with him is he always seems very sort of measured, but also very intense when you speak to him. And it's interesting how that comes through, even when you're doing it through the medium of a Zoom call. And, so he's sitting away back from the camera, but he sort of fixes you with those eyes. You can tell he's not lying to you. He's a very interesting and frank and honest person. So I don't think he, unlike a lot of drivers who fill you full of porkies, and a lot of people in Formula One just lie blatantly to your face, he is just a very honest, straightforward guy, which is why he's so popular with the team. Whether he's deluding himself that he is in with a chance is another thing. But I don't know whether he is in his happy place. I think he thinks he's getting there, but whether he actually, when he gets there, he'll find out whether he is there, if you see what I mean. I think he's sort of still he's on a journey trying to find somewhere. And if he does end up at his happy place, he might actually think, I'm here now. But for now, he's still on the way. I'm wondering how many laps of the same subject I did there. But yeah, I think I got over the essential nub of the point, which is, he's perhaps he might never get there. I was thinking, Mark, when you were talking about drivers who never quite make it, or they achieve more in lesser teams than they do in a major one. Ivan Capelli went to Ferrari as an up-and-coming hotshot, and you got him at Jordan, the broken remnants.
Yeah, no, that's right. And actually, Ivan's a really good example of someone who in the lower Formula was just terrific and then got to Formula One with a team that he loved and who loved him at Leighton House March. And the team is run by my former colleague, Ian Phillips, and they had a certain Adrian Newey designing the cars. And I was actually a pit lane commentator in France when Ivan nearly won the French Grand Prix in a Leighton House March. And he then went and was utterly destroyed by what happened to him at Ferrari. And I had the occasion to have quite a long chat with him about, I think it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago in Suzuka. We were sharing commentary boxes adjacent to one another. And we ended up having a very long conversation about everything that had happened. And yeah, you know, he got what he was dreaming of. He got to Formula One and he got to drive for Ferrari, and they discovered it was a complete nightmare. And I think it's interesting, Cotters, you know, you talked about that Valtteri's on a journey. There's a danger that he's on a journey that will never end until he simply exits Formula One. You know, he's never actually going to find his happy place. And in an interesting way, so he's managed by Didier Coton. And, I sometimes think that especially someone experienced like Didier, he'll know Valtteri's frustrations. And I think the really interesting thing is what happens next for Valtteri, because Valtteri will have so much to bring the next team that he goes to, if there is a next team. And that's what's quite important is what do the other nine teams think of Valtteri Bottas? Because when he leaves Mercedes-Benz, let's be clear, he's not likely to go to Red Bull. He's not likely to go to Ferrari. Where could he go to? I would actually argue that the very, very best outcome for Valtteri, and I know this may sound incredibly strange thing to say, would be a direct swap. I think he should go back to Williams and George Russell should come to Mercedes, and we see what George can do at Mercedes, because I have a feeling Williams are on the way up and Valtteri will help them to accelerate that, because he will bring with him all of the huge knowledge that he has gained driving for Mercedes-Benz. And, you know, kind of kind of at a similar stage in his career to where David Coulthard was when he left McLaren and went to Red Bull. You know, Valtteri could go to Williams, safe in the knowledge that he's very unlikely to score another podium. But my goodness, he could help them to climb up into regular point scoring positions. And that might be the, that might become the happiest experience for him, going back to a team that actually knows him and they enjoyed having him. You know, Williams enjoyed their time with Valtteri and he performed very well for them. And that for me, there'd be a nice balance achieved there. And so I have a suspicion that certainly as long as he's up against Lewis, Valtteri will never truly find a happy place at Mercedes, albeit, you know, he can still win the old Grand Prix. But I think at Williams, he might find a team that, that would really pull around him. And he could be a very valuable part of their plan. So Jost, Capito, if you happen to be listening to the podcast, you know, give Valtteri a pull Valtteri's CV out of your drawer there, because he might be part of your grand plan to bring Williams back up into consistent point scoring positions.
They are an interesting team that's going places at the moment, and they were very useful in terms of engineering contribution in one of our other features this month, where we looked at the whole floor gate fiasco, where the one of the package of changes that had been brought in this year has been to snip a little bit off the floor of the cars, and Mercedes feel that they've been targeted by that as a sort of a punitive measure to peg them back. And Aston Martin think that they're collateral and are contemplating legal action. And I've had a very interesting chat with Dave Robson, the Williams engineer, who said, obviously, we haven't simulated, we run a high-rate car. We haven't simulated what a low-rate car, the effects would be there. But it's just, from my point of view, it's too early to say definitively whether this change has had one effect or the other. And anyone who says that it's absolutely nailed on that the effect of these changes has been to peg back the cars that run lower rake, they either have access to a lot more data than anyone else in Formula One, or they're massively overstating their position. And it does seem to be that when you look in the final analysis, how many races have Mercedes won this season, despite supposedly having a much slower car and being at a colossal disadvantage? Obviously, you know, there's Lewis's presence dragging results out of the car, but maybe Red Bull haven't been that good at making the advantage stick. But it does cleave to this alternative narrative that actually people have been moaning about something that they probably shouldn't have been moaning about.
Potentially, like Formula One teams overstating their case, surely that's never happened in the history of Formula One before, has it? It feels like maybe there's been a slight overreaction to the events of Bahrain, where you saw a much bigger swing in performance between qualifying and the race between Mercedes and Red Bull. I mean, Red Bull maintained throughout that Mercedes was slightly quicker, certainly through a race distance, and felt that they underperformed in qualifying. And then the subsequent races have kind of borne that out. I think depending on which side you're on, you see it differently. Red Bull, particularly Jos Verstappen, thinks that Max is driving the wheels off the car and he's making that fight happen, when in fact the car isn't quite capable of being in that fight on its own. And Mercedes will say, oh, the Red Bull's right there, it's the quickest car, as they did after Bahrain, and we've got to play catch up. But they caught up pretty quick, and by Spain, you know, Lewis seemed to have it, you know, pretty much under control. But you know, that's even with the budget cap in place, that's a mighty team that knows how to react to challenges. Obviously, teams haven't had much testing. They know the cars, but the changes have been quite, not totally dramatic, but they've been quite involved in terms of how you re-engineer everything. I mean, Cod, as you explain it quite well in the feature, you know, there's some small changes, but there's a few of them and they all intersect and affect how the cars perform aerodynamically. So obviously the better equipped, better funded, more personnel teams will be able to solve those problems quicker. And it seems that that's what Mercedes has done. Maybe Bahrain turns out to be an anomaly rather than the beginnings of a pattern. Whereas a team like Aston Martin is a much smaller outfit, took on a car concept, cloned a car concept, if you want, that it didn't know, has had one disrupted season with basically no testing or very limited testing, trying to understand it, And then they've added a suspension upgrade on top, which is another thing they didn't develop or understand. So they've got to do a lot more learning on that car, I think, probably than any other team on the grid. So it's no surprise to me that, you know, whether or not the rule changes affect one philosophy more than another, they had the biggest amount of homework to do going into this season, given the way they've gone about doing a car for the last 2 years under the worst conditions. So it's no surprise to me that they've dropped off perhaps more than any other team on the grid.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, going back to some of the things you were saying, Cotter's, given the fact that these regulations may have been designed to peg Mercedes back, you know, Lewis has won three and finished second in the fourth. So it's been a failure,
hasn't it? Like,
you know, I think Valtteri would take that kind of failure, wouldn't he? Yeah. That level of disappointment is something that, you know, I think would even put a smile on his face. But the whole thing is really fascinating because, again, and then when you talk about, you know, Jos Verstappen saying Max is driving the wheels off the car, he is driving the wheels off the car over the white track limit.
There goes the can of worms.
Which, you know, let's face it, has been incredibly costly for him in qualifying, in the race. You know, definitely lost a victory, definitely lost a pole position. And again, it comes back to what we were talking earlier on, talking about Valtteri Bottas. Now we're going to talk about Max Verstappen. He's not as good as Lewis in terms of that ability to be complete. And, you know, I can hear all the Verstappen fans shouting at me at the moment. I'm a big Verstappen fan. I love Red Bull. I mean, I work for the team. I regard them as, you know, the kind of the savior of Formula One. Frankly, all the other car companies have really struggled to beat Mercedes-Benz. Red Bull, an energy drinks company, is the only one that seems to take a fight to them these days. It's fantastic what they achieve. And Max is brilliant. But he's not as brilliant at Lewis as that if Lewis was putting the car over the white lines, he would never repeat that a second time. He would fully understands the implications of every error. And you have to be error-free to win races and to win world championships. And that's across the board. And in the last race in Spain, okay, the four-second pit stop was not the difference between winning and losing, but you can't afford to have a driver come unexpectedly into the pit lane if you're serious about winning world championship titles. You know, miscommunications on the radio, driver makes a decision, Max turns up, the tires aren't quite ready. Those are the errors that Mercedes focuses on in order to make sure that they learn from every mistake so that there is never a repeat of that. Now, that's not to say that Mercedes don't have bad days. You only have to ask George Russell about bad days of Mercedes. He can tell you chapter and verse. He has 100% failure rate while driving for Mercedes-Benz. But the reality is that with these regulations, to your point, Ben, the Aston Martin F1 team is a very small outfit. It's not so long ago that it was a pretty well bankrupt Formula One team struggling for survival. It's been rebuilding, and we all know it takes 3 to 5 years to really achieve your potential, even if you've got a huge amount of money. I think it's very unfortunate that Otmar has chosen to take some of the line that he has in terms of taking legal action. It's just, it sounds like just screaming into the wind. There's just no point. The rules and the regulations are all agreed upon. It applies to everyone. It's incredibly unfortunate that Aston Martin are collateral damage. And they are collateral damage for the reasons you said, Ben. They've taken someone else's car or the fundamentals of someone else's car. And of course, the danger of copying, but I'm not talking about, I'm not getting into the intellectual property discussion here. I'm just saying, I'm talking about concepts. And we've seen this over the years in Formula One, where people endeavor to replicate the concept of another car. And it is very seldom successful, because if you are not the originator of every aspect of the design, merely trying to emulate that, you're never going to quite get the same level of performance. It's one of the reasons I love the fact that Gordon Murray stuck a big fan on the back of the Brabham in order to get the ground effect that you know, to match the Lotuses and you know, had that famous race in Sweden, because the, you know, Gordon was like, well, actually, I don't know how to generate that amount of downforce with, you know, underbody aerodynamics, so I'll just stick a big fan on. I think that's a much purer approach to trying to catch up. You know, really, we don't quite understand their innovation, so, but we know what they're trying to achieve, so we'll take a different avenue towards doing that. Aston Martin are in the position of having to follow the leader in this respect, which is Mercedes. And to your point, Ben, Mercedes have got strength in depth and this ability to react. They actually have for Ferrari and for Red Bull in particular, Mercedes-Benz have a worrying ability to react, much more so than Ferrari or Red Bull have ever shown. And I don't quite understand why that is the case, but
2017, I think that's why it's the case, because the last major rule reset, which they started agreeing in 2015, but obviously it came in to being in 2017. You know, that was a massive test for Mercedes. They saw that as an attempt to dethrone them. You know, everyone thinks our success is down to the engine. The cars are going to become, you know, aerodynamic super beasts on steroids, and that's going to bring Red Bull right back into the fight and we're going to be in trouble. And of course it didn't happen. Mercedes were enormously proud of their ability to transition from one set of aerodynamic rules to another and still be double world champions, because usually when something that monumental happens in the regulations, the team on top doesn't stay on top. And so I think the lessons they applied and the preparation they did to achieve that has stood them in good stead, because they now think, well, anything they throw at us, we know how to ingest that, spot the booby traps, and even if we get tripped up a little bit at the start, we know we can disarm them eventually. And let's not forget, in this situation, in the major rule reset isn't coming until next season. These cuts, I think, were principally aimed not, I mean, you can argue whether it was a veiled attempt to peg back Mercedes, but Formula One insists the idea is actually to give a taster of what's to come. Let's cut the downforce numbers, one for safety, because Pirelli's tyres are creaking and we want to have no failures. And, you know, they're struggling to keep up with the downforce loads being generated by the cars. And also we want to see if we cut downforce in this way, will cars be able to follow more easily? Will the racing improve? And that's the test, I think, we have to judge the rules by at the moment. I'd say the jury's out. I mean, the tyres are coping. We haven't had any failures yet, but we haven't been to Spa. We haven't been to Silverstone. We haven't been to Suzuka. As far as the
racing.
We
might not.
And indeed, yeah, we might not. We might not find out. And in terms of the wheel-to-wheel racing, I mean, it doesn't seem to have followed any different pattern to before. You know, Barcelona is a nightmare to overtake on and still is. And races like Bahrain, especially with extra DRS zones, a little bit more exciting. So the idea that it's, you know, if there's a happy side effect in bringing Mercedes back towards the pack, then I'm sure Formula One isn't unhappy about that. But it's more likely that the stability, relative stability in the rules has helped Mercedes rivals, apart from obviously Aston Martin for the reasons mentioned, because obviously everybody's understanding their cars much better. Red Bull certainly were on this trajectory at the end of last year because they kept developing RB16. From a difficult start point, and by the last three races they were right in the mix. You know, the pattern we're seeing in qualifying, certainly at the start of this season, between Verstappen and the best of the Mercedes, whether it's Bottas or Lewis, is broadly similar to what we were seeing in the Middle East at the end of 2020. So it feels like there's a bit of a red herring in all of this.
Though the midfield is very tight, isn't it? We've, you know, another of our, not to bang the drum for exclusives again, but we have an exclusive with Pierre Gasly. It kicks off very strongly. Alex Kalinauskas has done the interview, and he mentions the fact that the team were disappointed with seventh at Imola. And when you think a team like AlphaTauri, which, with the outlier of Monza last year aside, hasn't been hugely successful for a long time. That's not their job. Their job is to bring forward young talent. And now all of a sudden they're, you know, shooting for top 10 positions and talking about being disappointed with seventh. So it shows how high their expectations are, doesn't it? And I mean, should we get into Pierre, a driver transformed and someone who's clearly in his happy place? And obviously there's no room for him back in Red Bull. Question is, would he want to go there again? I'm not sure. I think he'd be a bit daft to want to go back to Red Bull, bearing in mind what happened to him there.
Well, I think his April Fool's social media post about the fact that he had just signed a contract with Alpine probably might well come back to haunt Franz Tost and Dr. Marco in the fullness of time, because I think that's the kind of team that maybe Pierre could well move to, and it would be, because you're right, he's very unlikely to go back to Red Bull, and if he has the aspiration to win more Grand Prix, it's not going to happen easily again at AlphaTauri. He might nick another win under fortuitous circumstances, and he did such a brilliant job for that particular victory in Italy. But he's a guy who, again, go back to our earlier conversation about Valtteri, you know, Pierre looks like he's in his happy place. He's had a horrific experience, being dropped by Red Bull Racing after, was it Hungary? It was between Hungary and Belgium, I think, he was dropped, you know, and it was all very sudden, and it was, you know, it was unseemly and it was embarrassing, and it looked like he was being really, you know, kicked into touch. And he's just come back so strongly. And let's remember, we all talk about the victory in Italy, but he finished second in Brazil, I think the penultimate round of the 2019 championship. So he's actually really thrived in that role, and it's been great to see. So he's a guy who has been through the journey that we were talking about with Valtteri earlier on. You know, you go on this journey to try and find that place where you can really excel. He's had that journey. He's excelling at AlphaTauri, and it is a measure of their ambition that they were disappointed, you know, with the seventh place. But you know, that is their lot. I mean, as a team, they don't fundamentally have the resource and the capability to become a consistent leader. They are a midfield team. They're there to do a particular job for Red Bull and for Dietrich Mateschitz, with, you know, his ambitions to now build a clothing brand, AlphaTauri. And Franz Tost does a really steady job as team principal there. And I think, you know, and they've got a pretty handy, good midfield car that can score championship points. It isn't ultimately going to play to Gasly's ambition. So I do expect that he'll eventually move on from there. And I think we will see him step away from the Red Bull environment. And whether it's an Alpine or could be a Williams again, he'd be another perfect driver to go into a resurgent Williams team. That's the kind of thing that I would expect to happen to him.
Yeah, I think he's had a very important lesson over the last couple of years, because he's been obviously burned by the experience at Red Bull, but he's now gone back to the team that he was at before. They know him, they know what he likes, how to get performance out of him, and it feels like he's managed to make himself heard in a way that he couldn't at Red Bull. And he talks very frankly in the interview about how AlphaTauri have engineered the car in a way that better suits his driving style. He likes to carry speed, a lot of momentum into the corners. And it seems that the Red Bulls he was driving before tended to give up a bit when driven that way. And he would spend a lot of time reacting then to problems. And he'd be trying to engineer out those problems. And then he'd get into a problem where the team's saying, well, you need to do this differently driving wise. And he'd be saying, well, we need to do this differently with the car so that I can drive it better. And they never really found an equilibrium. But with AlphaTauri, they've engineered the car more in his direction, and he's getting more out of himself. And it just shows there are kind of two ways to skin the cat, if you like. There are some drivers who are super adaptable. Yeah, sorry, Connors. Hopefully your cats are not in earshot. Mine's asleep, so apologies to cats everywhere. Some drivers, and the best drivers, let's face it, the ones that are going to be world championship material, are really adaptable. You know, you can throw almost anything at them engineering wise and they'll be able to drive it, they'll be able to get the lap time out of it. They won't be hamstrung by this bit of understeer at this phase of the corner or this bit of oversteer at that phase of the corner. But it's not the same for every driver, and the cleverer drivers who are limited by certain behavioral traits learn how to recognize the traps and how to work with the teams to fix those and get the car to their liking. Daniel Ricciardo did this really well at Renault. He probably got out of Red Bull partly because he could see the direction of the car going away from him and making it harder for him to drive the way he wants to, because his style is different to Max Verstappen's. He's now in the new fight of trying to get that balance at McLaren, because, you know, he's trying to feel out that team and that car and what it can do and what he doesn't like. Gasly's now had that lesson, I think, and it's, he can make it work for him. Kimi Raikkonen is probably the most extreme example. He's a guy who, throughout his career, love him or loathe him, has always said, I don't like understeer, engineer the understeer out of the car and I'll get you the lap time. And he'll just keep complaining if that trait is there. And you can say, on the one hand, well, he's limited by that trait, so that means he's not an absolute top-line driver. But by the same token, he's at least consistent and honest. And if you can give him the right car, he's capable of producing exceptional performances. And that's true of probably a lot of drivers on the grid. So it's just about which end you approach the problem from. Obviously, the one where you adapt means you're more in control of your own destiny. So you have more in your own hands. Whereas obviously, if you rely on the team, and in Formula One's case, many, many engineers and different brains and different ideas to kind of get you into a place where you can do your best stuff, then it's a little bit more complicated. I'm at least happy for Pierre that he's been able to find that place, regain his confidence. And of course, winning that race, however fortuitous the circumstances, is massive for him, because he now is a Grand Prix winner. He knows that when he's in circumstances at the front of a race, he can deliver under pressure. You know, he had Carlos Sainz coming at him for the last part of that race. He had to drive on the limit, make no mistakes in order to achieve that victory. It was a well-earned victory, even if the normal suspects weren't in the mix. And he'll take that with him through the rest of his career. He'll take enormous self-belief from that, which won't be shaken by the fact that he had a chastening experience at Red Bull beforehand.
How telling is it, do we think, that the guy in the other car, Yuki Tsunoda, is starting to flounder a little bit and starting to make silly statements, ask silly questions, just suggesting that your car isn't the same as the other car? Although it is slightly Sesame Street, isn't it? This car is not much like that car. It gets you in trouble.
I think that's the other side of the same coin. So you've got a driver going into a team who's completely green. You know, he's come from F2, he doesn't have much experience, he's had very little testing. Okay, he's done some running in older cars to get, you know, extra mileage and what have you. But he's coming into a team where the teammate has had his feet under the table and started to get the car moulded in a direction that suits him. And if Tsunoda doesn't drive in a way that's similar to Pierre Gasly, he is going to find that the car has some traits that perhaps don't work for him, especially when he isn't yet in a position where he can know which direction to go on setup. You know, new drivers in Formula One are always bamboozled by the amount of tools available, the amount of different setup directions you can go in. Someone like Tsunoda, as naturally gifted as he might be in terms of car control, is going to need direction from the team around him. And that direction is going to come mainly from his teammate. And if that doesn't mesh with how he naturally drives, he's going to have not every circuit, but some situations where he struggles. And that, I think, is what's happened so far. And the first reaction to that from him has been to really have a meltdown, if you like, in his head and go, I just don't understand how I'm not able to drive this car and have the same feedback and get the lap time out of it. Sometimes the messages are just confusing to a driver, and depending on the way they like to drive. And I think you saw a similar thing with Vettel last year at Ferrari. You know, the way the cars were going, the way the handling was going, was very, very nervous at the rear end on that Ferrari. Leclerc was able to deal with it, you know, relatively well, but still recognised it. For Vettel, it just completely, it broke his circuit board, if you like. And at one point in that season, he started questioning the quality of the equipment. Yeah, and he's a four-time world champion with way more experience and much more knowledge than Yuki Tsunoda. So happens to the best of them.
Yeah, I think the ninth place finish in the opening round was probably the worst possible outcome in some ways, because it gave Tsunoda and everyone watching him the, you know, kind of false sense of how he was going to be from then on. And it's been a struggle. And it's, you know, to your point, Ben, it shows a naivety and an immaturity for him to have responded in the way that he has, it's maybe understandable because you can imagine driving a Honda powered AlphaTauri. The guy's already a kind of legend status in Japan at home, and he's, you know, the PR is intense, and he's got hundreds of thousands of fans worshipping the fact that he's come into Formula One and is the new superstar for Japan. And the trouble is that's all irrelevant. You know, Yuki has to ignore all of that and realize he hasn't arrived. He's at the beginning of his Formula One career, and he has a vast amount to learn. And, you know, it's something that Mika Häkkinen often talks about. It took him 7 years before he won his very first Grand Prix. And if everyone thinks of Mika as a phenomenal, you know, driver and world champion, he had horrendous seasons. He had to learn from everyone that he partnered with, and
he had horrendous even cars Julian as well, Bailey. Didn't he?
he did have horrendous cars. He's never voluntarily driven a Peugeot rental car since. but it's interesting that, you know, we see this, don't we? And I think it, you know, where people pile the pressure on these young drivers when they come into Formula, they have to deliver. No, they have to learn. And while they're learning, their job is to drive consistently and to bring the car home and to learn and to improve every weekend. And when you come out with something where you begin to suggest that you're not being given fair treatment by the team, when you have literally just arrived yesterday morning in Formula One and now today you're complaining about that shows a huge lack of understanding of the complexity of Formula One, of the fact that this is not another junior formula. This is not a formula where Yuki can walk in the door and suddenly he's going to, you know, set the world on fire. He's got a lot of learning to do. And again, you know, Ben, to your point, that sort of learning from your teammate, you know, understanding how you slot in. You know, he should be all over listening to what Pierre's got to say. He's very fortunate to be beside someone who knows what it's like to win a Grand Prix. And there's so much to learn there. And I think, you know, if Tsunoda wants to stay in Formula One long after Honda leaves, because, you know, for all that Dr. Marco and Red Bull like what Yuki represents and the opportunity of his talent, once the Japanese dimension in terms of the Honda involvement has gone, he needs to be performing at a good enough level to justify keeping there. And if he, you know, I can't remember exactly the statistics, but the number of drivers who have come into Formula One over the years and only had a 1 or 2 year career because you don't actually establish yourself. Yuki has to establish himself. And the best way to do that is to keep his head down and just to keep doing, getting the fundamentals right in Formula One and respecting the team that he drives for. You know, there's no one in that team turning up for work thinking, how can we have him over? you know, the opposite's true. They want to help him. So I'm sure he's had some fairly frank responses from Franz Tost and probably the old phone call from Helmut Marko as well.
And the apology was pretty swift, wasn't it? after he made his comments.
You just imagine the old iPhone bursting into life.
Yeah, it was swifter than his qualifying performance in Spain. but also that speaks to how close, as we were talking earlier, the midfield is. You know, it doesn't take much, especially at a track like Barcelona, to be 15th or 16th and out in Q1 in a car that should be in the top 10, because the gaps were incredibly close. There was something like half a second across the top 14 in Q1. In Spain, and that includes the Mercedes and the Red Bulls. So if you take them out and you just compare the midfield cars, you know, there's not going to be much in it. We're talking a few tenths here or there, and that kind of performance is very easy to gain or lose depending on how comfortable you feel in the car. So like you say, Mark, Tsunoda just needs to kind of shut the noise out and focus on the important stuff, which is and stop making the noise himself.
Stop
as
making
well
noise is a good
yes
thing.
Indeed yeah
it's just Isn't it interesting that when you look at the conversations we've had on this call about Valtteri, about Pierre, about Tsunoda, the mental side of being, you know, the mental health of Formula One drivers, how are they within themselves, their confidence level, their, and how important that is in their performance and how they work with their teammate and how they fit within the team and how they focus on the job at hand. And the more noise is inside their head in terms of, you know, what's going wrong here, the kind of all of the emotion that can start to come with operating at the pinnacle of world motorsport, that just gets in the way. That's just noise. And I think, you know, again, go back to, I think it was you, Cotters, who mentioned earlier on, certainly one of you mentioned earlier on about the fact that Valtteri has maybe tried taking a leaf out of Lewis Hamilton's book by, you know, getting away from it all and having hobbies. You know, he's got his, with his partner, Tiffany Cromwell, you know, they go cycling a lot together and that kind of thing. And again, that's an insight, isn't it, into a driver has to find their level that's going to enable them to turn up each week and absolutely deliver. And I suspect it's different for everyone. Some drivers, like Lewis, really benefit from getting away from it all and doing something completely different. Other drivers maybe benefit from staying absolutely laser-focused. They might burn themselves out quicker, but maybe that's the only way that they can deliver it. And for Tsunoda, yeah, it's all about just – he needs to take a step back, take a helicopter view of where he's at in his career. He's right at the beginning in Formula One. He's clearly got a great talent and a good ability. Personally, I like to hear him swearing a little bit less. I think it's a slightly unfortunate development of Formula One in the Liberty era, where we get a lot more radio communications. There's so much swearing goes on.
That's the real Formula One, though, isn't it? Anyone who's worked in motorsport knows it's one of the most sweary industries on the planet. Yeah, I think Formula One audiences have been sanitized for the most part, and now we're seeing how people really talk.
Could we do an X-rated podcast at some point where we actually get to talk about people in the real terms?
Martin.
What you mean, the bit that's edited out every time?
Moving on, there is a lot more to enjoy in this month's GP racing. Exclusive visit to the location of the forthcoming Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. A fascinating photographic essay by Steve T. We've also got lots of other stuff planned for next month, but including you've spoken to Sergio Perez, haven't you, Ben? More on that in a few weeks. Elsewhere in this month's GP racing, we discover Mick Schumacher's love of chess.
Is this like the Queen's Gambit second series, the Mick Schumacher?
The Mick Schumacher years. He plays chess and backgammon.
I think it's a bit less raunchy than the Queen's Gambit.
Yes. Oh God, Mrs. Codling's planning to start watching Bridgerton on a Sunday night when I'm doing the Autosport podcast after races. So I think I've dodged a bullet there. And now, once again, we digress. Our history of Lotus reaches the Jim Clark years. Now that was a car, covers the final Ferrari Grand Prix winner of Enzo Ferrari's life, the F1 87/88. Nigel Roebuck's racing hero is Riccardo Patrese. What a lovely bloke Riccardo Patrese is. Parenthetically speaking. And do not forget to visit gpracing.com for our latest subscription offers, one of which you can get 3 issues for £3 if you sign up to direct debit, which is cheap at thrice the price, I would say.
Very good.
Keep us all in work. Keep this podcast going. Thank you, Mark. It's great to have you back in the country with your nice picture of Fangio in the background.
Yeah, pleasure as always. And on the Riccardo Patrese note, given that Nigel Roebuck's written about him, go on YouTube and just YouTube Riccardo Patrese giving his wife a lap. Giving his wife a lap of...
You had to get your words correct then, didn't you? You had to be very careful what you said.
A high-speed lap of a track in a Honda. I think it's a Civic Type R, and it's absolutely hilarious, and it's had many, many hundreds of thousands of views of her screaming while he drives around. And he is a delightful guy. I had the pleasure of spending a day with him at his home not too far from Venice, way back when I was doing some work with Canon, when they were sponsoring Williams. And he was a super guy then, and he's a super gentleman today.
Yeah. Lovely, lovely, excitable sounding voicemail message when you ring him and he doesn't pick up. It's ciao, ciao.
Someone definitely in their happy place there.
Oh, indeed. And having done so after being Nigel Mansell's teammate, you know, that's some going. But anyway, before we get onto that subject and annoy lots more people, thank you, Ben Anderson, live from home.
Thank you very much. Yeah, very enjoyable podcast. And very good issue of the magazine, if I do say so myself. I'm very proud of the effort of the team for putting that together. So yeah, hopefully you all enjoy it.
Yeah, more than a year of producing it in lockdown now. And as we contemplate the office reopening, we might be able to have a pub lunch somewhere and discuss content via a medium other than Microsoft Teams. Other video conferencing apps are available, including quite a lousy one by Amazon I had to use the other day. But anyhow, we digress again. Thanks to you for listening, and thanks to our long-suffering producer, Martin Lee. This has been a Motorsport Network production. Thank you very much for listening.